the Spot Track Podcast, talking sports contracts, the salary cap, and business of sports.
Welcome to another edition of the Spot Track Podcast. My name is Mike Finetti. It is Monday, April 8th. Total eclipse is nearing the Eastern Coast. I'm here in Buffalo where people are kind of going crazy for it. So we'll get in, we'll get out. It's a two-part show today. NFL recaps at the top, some notable notes, right? Stephon Diggs, Derek Brown, Kyle Duggar. And then a quick baseball segment. Cousin Dan's going to join, talk some of these injuries, some of these extensions, some payroll updates now that we're about 2 weeks into this thing. And we'll see where we go from there. Off the top, tried to take a family vacation with the kids, and Buffalo decided to trade Stephon Diggs halfway through it. So we got a little work in. Obviously, we took last week off with the pods. Appreciate you giving me that kind of patience. We're back. There's an article live on spotdraft.com detailing this Stephon Diggs trade. I'm sure you know the numbers. Everybody in the world is discussing this dead cap hit. It's one of the reasons why this was an unlikely scenario, and Buffalo made it very likely. And they didn't even wait until June 1st to do this because, as you know, with many of these teams, this is a draft loaded with hole pluggers, right? Wide receivers to get deeper with or even start over, as Buffalo is doing here. Defensive tackles, edge rushers, offensive tackles. It's a chalk draft for a lot of teams, right? These are positions that every team is looking to upgrade every single year. And if you can do so on a rookie contract, teams are going to go that route. That's what Buffalo is doing here. I'm not saying they're out on a player like Brandon Ayuk if the price becomes doable, both from a trade compensation and an extension standpoint. Those kind of players are still involved here. I wouldn't say that Buffalo is eyeing Justin Jefferson, as I've heard in some channels. But Ayuk at least is a fringe maybe with this Bills offseason here. Now I'm approaching it, right? Because that second round pick that they acquired in 2025 is twofold. It's threefold, really. A, it becomes a great pick for them next year if they do nothing with it. B, it becomes ammo for them to move up in this current draft with all the, you know, the notes I just gave you. C, is that enough to get Brandon Ayuk right now? Probably. It probably is because of the contract extension that has to come with it. You can't put all of these scenarios in one box and say, this is how it works. Everybody comes with a different package, and Brandon Ayuk needs money, and he probably needs $100 million. All right. He probably needs four for $100 million because that's just where we are with Michael Pittman and T. Higgins and those kind of players. So that second round pick is not enough for a lot of fans out there who saw Stephon Diggs leave Buffalo for just that. And by the way, Buffalo had to sweeten the pot with a fifth and a sixth. So that was probably a third round pick until Buffalo did that. But that's a useful tool for them. And if they do nothing and make that pick next year, great. Okay, that's going to be a great pick. Did Houston get better? Of course. Of course Houston got better. They got deep as hell at this wide receiver position. There's probably a move or two coming to trim some of that. Nobody notable. I would say the Nico Collins, the Noah Browns, the Robert Woods of the world are safe for 2024. And 2024 is where we have to discuss this, because this was a four-year, $75 million contract when that trade happened. And shortly after that, we learned that Houston renegotiated the hell out of this thing into a one-year, $22.5 million contract that's basically fully guaranteed. All right, there's some per gamers. There's a workout bonus. The workout bonus is certainly going to be paid out. The $255K of per gamers obviously relies on Stephon Diggs' foot ankle holding up, which has been kind of a thing for the past couple of seasons, but it's minimal in the grand scheme of things. So we noted what happened on Twitter. There were $18.5 million guaranteed to start. That was his base salary for 2024. Excuse me, $18 million. And there was $3.5 million from 2025 that was guaranteed for injury. That would have vested next March. Houston just took all that, combined it into a one-year contract, and guaranteed it. Now, they used some void years here, made most of it a signing bonus. In fact, 20.8 million of that is now a signing bonus. So his cap charge for 2024 is now only 5.8 million. So they made it work for 2024. They sweetened the pot for Stephon Diggs, handing him all of his guarantees, the full guarantee this year, the injury guarantee next year, as cash in hand. And I guess this is to make sure that he's max motivated. Have they not seen Stephon Diggs on a sideline? This dude gets pissed off every play that he's not involved. Every single play. He's one of the most competitive, self-motivated human beings in the world, let alone in the NFL. So I'm not positive he needed the extra $3.5 million to get there, but the only other explanation I can make with this is Houston's just showing the world that they mean business. And I mean that metaphorically speaking and literally speaking, because they have spent three straight off seasons, and I've been haphazardly joking about this, right? Basically just handing out one-year contracts at vet mins, at slightly above vet mins. They just brought in 30 free agents, five at each position, truly, and tried to figure out a core unit. And now they have one for sure. And they've done a lot more damage in this free agency. And, you know, you can look at this Diggs deal and say, well, this is just a one-year contract. No, you're right. That's just how Nick Caserio wants to operate. And where did he come from? New England. And what did they do there? They kept everything short and sweet from the quarterback down. All right. It was extremely rare when a massive blockbuster multi-year extension was signed in New England during any kind of that Tom Brady heyday. Stephon Gilmore is the one that comes to mind from Buffalo subsequently. It didn't happen because they didn't operate that way. They played more of a revolving door process. Yes, Houston is going all in with some of these free agent moves, but they are still operating basically in tight windows. If you go and look at the multi-year breakdown that we have on SpotTrack for the Houston Texans, there's an awful lot of pending UFAs in 2025. An awful lot at every position group. There's at least one or two, including quarterbacks, all of the backup quarterbacks now to CJ Stroud. Many of the linebackers, much of the defensive line. All of the secondary, not named Derek Stingley Jr., who's going to get paid next year. All right. This is a tight knit, short and sweet group. This is how it's operating. Even Laremy Tunsil's extension only runs through 2026 and only 2025 when we talk about guarantees. So it's just the way they're doing business there. So they didn't want Stephon Diggs on 4 years. They trimmed the fat down for motivational reasons, for their own window of contention reasons. This is not how they're doing business right now. Dalton Schultz is on a 2 year that looks like a 3 year on paper. Everybody on the roster, at least, and anybody of utter importance, has a cut line after 2025, many of them after 2024. So I give Houston a lot of credit for sticking to the philosophy. You know that they have a plan in place and it's built around CJ Stroud. Because what else happens after 2025? CJ Stroud becomes extension eligible. And if this is the dude he is, right, even if he's a semblance of this next year, it's going to be fun. All right. He's going to need that top of the market quarterback contract. And they're going to have to pick and choose who gets veteran contracts along with this. We saw this in similar fashion to Joe Mixon. All right. Which is also guarantee aligned now with 2025. That's the big year. That's the line of demarcation for the Houston Texans. And it all surrounds, right, around CJ Stroud, who is the son here, right? And when that son has to become $150 million guaranteed, they better have everything else on the roster in order. And they're going to be able to pick and choose because of the way that they're operating right now, both in 2023 and now in the 2024 offseason. So bit of an eyebrow-raising move in the renegotiation to Diggs. But if you think about it in this context, it just fits their plan. It just fits their plan. For Buffalo, of course, this is a historic dead cap hit, not only for them as a franchise, but for anyone without a quarterback designation attached to them. This is the highest single season dead cap hit for a non-quarterback in the history of the NFL. It's just over $31 million. It's the highest cap hit that Buffalo will take on this year after cap converting a little bit of Josh Allen's down to 30.3. Everything about this is huge. It's the sixth highest single season dead cap hit of all time behind five quarterbacks. Everything about it is massive. There's really not much else to say outside of the fact that Buffalo wanted to do damage in this upcoming draft, which means this had to happen now, not after June 1st. This is a reset year, as I made note of in this article on SpotTrack.com. And that doesn't mean that they've slammed their contention window shut. It doesn't mean that the nine players who left this roster, seven of basically starters, were cap cuts, right? Were actual cap casualties, as we kind of say in the industry here. Many of these players just aged out, and bringing them back on $6-7 million even wasn't the way to go, because the way that teams are operating with those kind of contracts now, look at the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, look at the Tennessee Titans, look at some of these teams that are pushing a little bit more than Buffalo is right now financially, right? They're using void years left and right and up and down. They're taking 1-year contracts and making them 5-year contracts with void years just to make sure that they can slide this player in cap wise in 2024. I'm not saying that's an incorrect way to operate. I'm saying Buffalo was not going to do that this year specifically. So keeping Jordan Poyer on $7 million, but having a cap convert him down to 2.5 with void years seems like a simple move, except that player is 32 years old. It's an area where they're going to probably hammer the draft. Why add 4 dummy years to make it work this year when you can just go get a 4-year contract from a draft pick and hope that it works out for the next 4 years on maybe even less than what you would have paid Jordan Poyer for one season, if we're talking about a 4th-round pick, for instance? That's the mindset right now. That's the reset that we're talking about that Brandon Bean has publicly stated out loud. Sure, some of these players got moved out because they were expensive, but age was a factor. Mitch Morse, Jordan Poyer. It's a hard cap league, okay? It's the only one that we track heavily, 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 heavily with these kind of moves, all right? The NBA can always flex out of this thing with sign-in trades, with luxury taxes. Baseball has the luxury tax, which means teams can go north of it as much as they want now. You can't do it in the NFL. And the way to get around the hard cap is to restructure and cap convert. And Buffalo basically just said out loud, we'll do that to some degree, you know, 5 or 10% of our moves, but we're going to use this as an opportunity to get younger and not do that with 75% of the contracts that are a little bit too rich for our blood right now. So are they a better team? And I'm not going to say they're a better team right now than they have been over the past 2 seasons. Could they be by the end of the summer? Sure. And that's not just with the draft. All right. There's a 4th wave of free agency still sitting out there. There's a 1st wave of trading still sitting out there. All right. There's a lot of time for contract negotiations to break down with Brandon Ayuk, with defensive linemen. Okay. We'll have those lists coming soon. The next segment we're going to get to here is focused on the wide receivers specifically. The name, we're in an unbelievable time for that position. And that includes everything from trade candidates to extension candidates to draft candidates. It's just a wild time. So we'll see where we get to with that. But I wouldn't say Buffalo's done. I wouldn't say they're better. I wouldn't say this move was unbelievably shocking, but the timeline of it certainly was. I thought for sure if this was going to happen, it was going to be a late summer once they figured out where they stood after the 2024 draft. Let's do something. But Brandon Bean got a 2nd-round pick. And as I noted at the top here, that was enough to make that $31 million cap hit work in their favor, because now they can use this in a multitude of ways, either replacing Diggs or replacing an immediate hole in the upcoming draft in the first couple of rounds by being able to maneuver with that 2025 second. All right, I mentioned the wide receivers. I have a list started. I will do more work on this. I started to do an extension candidate list as a whole, the whole league, because it's that time of year, right? Most teams have now settled away from their free agency stuff, and it's about keeping some of their own I couldn't stop finding wide receivers that needed a payday. Maybe not immediately, right? There's a few of them immediately. I would say Amari Cooper, St. Brown, T. Higgins are in that kind of, and Brandon Ayuk are in that category, even though the franchise tag is kind of coming for some of these, I think. But here's the list I came with. CeeDee Lamb is going to be the big one because the whole conversation in Dallas is still super stale. And there's a Dak off the field incident. There's a Dak contract. All of that probably supersedes CeeDee Lamb's ability to get paid here. Is he going to hold out? Yeah, I think he will. I think he probably won't see CeeDee Lamb in a Cowboys jersey. Maybe deep into training camp, right? I mean, he's in a situation on his fifth year option where training camp fines would be $40,000 a day. He'd lose a game check if he starts missing preseason games, which would come down to about a little under $1 million a game. If he doesn't have his contract, I don't know why he'd show up. By the way, Dallas can waive all those fines. They've done that quite a few times in the past. So he's at the top of this list. And outside of Jefferson, he's like a 1B with where I think the contract should hit. And I don't think he wants to sign a contract until Justin Jefferson signs a contract. And the same would go for Ja'Marr Chase, who we haven't heard too much about in Cincinnati, right? I mean, Chase is in a bit of a different situation. He's not yet on his fifth-year option. This is year four. So he's just now become extension eligible. My guess is Cincinnati wants to ride this out with Chase, who's on a $9.8 million cap hit. He's going to make $4.8 million cash this year. And they want to use that in conjunction with T. Higgins' franchise tag that they don't want to move off of. And those two combined, that's pretty nice value for two wide receivers, two top-level wide receivers. Okay? My guess is that's where they want to be living right now. They don't want to do anything. So I'm not going to focus too much on Cincinnati's wide receivers because I don't think there's going to be any movement there. I could be wrong. Ja'Marr Chase may be in negotiations right now, and I'll have to react to that certainly. But to me, it's Justin Jefferson, CeeDee Lamb as a 1-1-B in that order. Lamb's not signing until Jefferson signs. Jefferson's probably not signing until he figures out what the hell the quarterback situation in Minnesota is going to look like, and nobody can blame him. In other words, if we're waiting until May, are any of these guys showing up? Probably not for these OTAs. We got to get through some more of the semantics of the offseason before these numbers come into focus. And by the way, the cap jumped exponentially this year, right? Exponentially to 255.4. So if Justin Jefferson was a $32 million per year player in our system in December, and I think he was easily, mathematically, right, value-wise, where's this thing going? Okay, where's this thing headed? You know, the non-quarterback contracts are now at 35. That's probably where Justin Jefferson has to live. And I don't know that anybody could really turn a cheek at it. He's been a unicorn since day one in this league. So that's what CeeDee Lamb is waiting for. You know how this works with Jerry and Stephen Jones. They wait to the very last minute, which is just the worst way to pay a player in the NFL. So post-draft, once Minnesota has something in place, I would expect Jefferson's deal to get done. And then that'll reset everything. There'll be a huge trickle-down effect. So it's Jefferson, then Lamb. Let's put Chase and Higgins in a holding pattern tier. Amari Cooper is on an expiring contract, but Jerry Jeudy has just been extended. Is that leverage? Does that mean Amari is not getting extended? We'll have to see. Jalen Waddle is the number two to Tyreek Hill, who's very well paid over the next 3 years. Is he in a holding pattern? Or will they try to lowball an offer that he just wants to take to stay on this roster? Possibly. Amon-Ra St. Brown has established himself as the true number one in Detroit. A little bit of a Dallas thing going on, right? Jared Goff probably has to get signed first. There's the left tackle. There's a couple more players defensively. Where does he fit, St. Brown, in this hierarchy of Lions contracts? Because it's going to be big. All right, it's going to be north of Pittman, north of those players that you think maybe got a little bit of an overpay this offseason. He's going to be in that second tier that we're talking about here. Devontae Smith, again, in the shadow of AJ Brown, who's 4 for 100 looks like peanuts now in comparison to where things are headed. Is he a true number two? Does he feel like he's a number one if he hops on a different roster? That's Ayuk's problem, right? That's what's happening with a lot of these players is they were drafted to be a wingman, but now they want to be paid like a true dog, like a true ace. That's a tough situation if you want to stay in your current roster, because we don't have many great examples of teams paying two wide receivers top level money and being able to compete as a full roster. We don't have great ones. It worked out with Brady and Evans and Godwin for a minute, but that fell apart pretty quickly. So Ayuk, Devontae Smith, Jalen Waddle, and I guess to some degree T. Higgins, even though I don't think he's getting touched, kind of in that unique situation of current wingman, definitely wants top tier money. Who's going to break? Who's going to compromise? And then I got a couple of fringe players. I mentioned Nico Collins and with Houston. He definitely had the 1 year. If he has another year, and I would imagine Houston makes him play out 2024, and then Diggs comes off the roster, is he the guy? Right? Are we talking about him as the top extension candidate for next year, not named maybe T. Higgins? Possibly. Chris Godwin, I just mentioned him. He's on an expiring contract. Mike Evans just got paid. Does that mean his time in Tampa Bay is dwindling? Is he a trade candidate right now? Will he be a deadline candidate? Definitely a name to watch. And then Keenan Allen, who just got moved to Chicago. DJ Moore has 2 years left, so they're probably not touching that contract. I would imagine, even though he's 30-something, Keenan Allen slots in ahead of DJ Moore from a production standpoint. He's on an expiring contract. Is it just a blip on the radar for now? They just want to kind of run these guys out as much as humanly possible in terms of what they have left? Or is he more of the Stephon Diggs, right? Who's going to come in and give 3-4 years for this Bears offense that's going to be super young, possibly extremely talented, and they just need a guy who can kind of keep everything together. It's an interesting dynamic. So those are three fringe players, but there's 8 to 10 players. Really good, strong wide receivers, 22 to 25 million plus per year, that are at least in the conversation right now. And they all have their own thing. There's team dynamics around them. There's contract dynamics, right? If you're on the franchise tag here, but it could be a huge, huge summer for these wide receivers after kind of a dud free agency, you know, Calvin Ridley and then the rest of them. So something to keep an eye on for sure. We'll see which one of these gets done first. I would imagine every agent in the world is waiting for Justin Jefferson so that the trickle-down effect can happen. And like I said, that means May or on, because I have a feeling that everything about Justin Jefferson's negotiations hinge on what happens in the draft day one. So it's a bit of a waiting game, but we're going to continue to build this list and put some projections out there and sort of play the game of what happens first and who comes first and who has to wait and what does this mean for potential franchise tags next year and all sorts of things like that. All right. A couple notable extensions that hit. Kyle Duggar was extended off of his transition tag to a super fair 4 for 58 that can get to 66 with incentives. 32.5 guaranteed. If you do that over two, that's a little over 16 guaranteed. If we do that, if that's the full guarantee, so some of that trickles into year three, you're probably talking about $15 million per year for the first two seasons, guaranteed at signing. It's right where we had him financially. I think it's right where he belongs, top 10 in terms of average pay for safeties. It's just another good example of a player using every avenue he had. You know, I applaud New England for using the transition tag, even though they had the most cap space in the league. Because what it did is it didn't put Kyle Duggar on a value that he didn't belong at. The second he gets that high franchise tag mark, that becomes the new negotiation mark. That's the floor. So is it risky to put him on the transition tag? To some degree, but man, offer sheets are just, if we get one a year like we did this year with Brock Wright, it's great. All right. It's just not a thing anymore in any of these sports. So I like the tactic. Put him on the number you want him to be at and then sign him to it. That's what New England did. So they haven't done a lot of things phenomenally right from a business standpoint lately, this is definitely one of them. And that's a guy you want to build your the next iteration of your team around, at least defensively speaking. So good move there. Derek Brown signed a 4 for $96 million with Carolina. I sure hope Bryce Young figures this thing out, because the rest of this Carolina roster is starting to get pretty damn expensive. Certainly love the player. Is this one of those things, though, where you had trade value, you know, and you could have used it? I know how much this team values the defensive line they have for, God, since their inception. It's been one of the most important position groups to the entire roster. It's a nice number. We'll see what the breakdown looks like. I just wonder, in the current climate, right? I'm fine with them building out the offensive line. I'm fine with them adding a couple of flyer weapons to increase Bryce Young's ability to, right, see open receivers. I'm fine with that. You need to get a look at what you can get a look at. I'm not sure this contract needed to happen, right? They did this one and not Brian Burns, right? Because they needed a second round pick. I'm just not sure this one needed to happen. Couldn't you have taken this one to the finish line? Maybe made him a deadline candidate? I'm not sure. But good numbers for him. We'll see what the breakdown looks like in a couple of days here when that becomes officially official. And a couple of Philadelphia Eagles moves, as you might expect, right? Because it's a day that ends in day. So Philadelphia is doing something from a business standpoint. They locked in tackle Jordan Mailata, 3 for $66 million. Breakdown on that still pending. And Reed Blankenship, their kind of gunner safety, gets a 1 for $3.5 million, fully guaranteed through next season. We'll keep up with it. Let's talk some baseball with Cousin Dan. All right, Dan, we're about 10 days into the baseball season here. Plenty of storylines, but the one that seems to not be going away are these early pitcher injuries. We had a couple over the winter, kind of some surprise Tommy John surgeries. And really within this first week, now we've got two massive aces down, Shane Bieber and Spencer Strider appear both headed for some sort of elbow surgery. Bieber has been confirmed. Strider is sort of full play in this process right now. And of course, we've got Gerrit Cole out, I don't know, through June, probably. That timeline seems murky as well. So super high profile, you know, big time money pitchers hitting the shelf. Question number one is this. Isn't this happening every year? I mean, is this really something to overreact about and have MLBPA send out an actual disclaimer saying we're pissed off about this and this is because of the rule changes? And I don't know. What's the actual climate of this thing? Because I do feel like there's been massive overreactions because of specifically the names that are involved this year.
Yeah, for sure. I mentioned to you earlier, I think it's a little bit prisoner of the moment where we saw two of the biggest names in baseball go down basically on the same day within a couple hours of each other. That in conjunction with Gerrit Cole, one of the best pitchers in baseball, already being out, like you just mentioned, a number of other names who have been sidelined early. I think it's a little bit of a perfect storm. That's not to discredit pitcher health. I don't think we're trying to do that at all. But, you know, we talk about this often. The narrative around something like this kind of gets swept up into the public view and everyone becomes an expert, if you will. And I think there's so many factors that come into this that anyone just yelling pitch clock right now, I think, is a little bit misguided. Not that that might not have something to do with all of this, but I think there are so many factors at so many levels of this that, you know, it's really short-sighted to just box it up into one neat problem, right?
Let's talk about the pitch clock quickly. I don't want to discredit it. It's new. It's for sure ramping up the pace of play, which is also ramping up the pitches, you know, and I'm not saying the pitchers are throwing more. They're probably throwing less, but they're doing so in smaller and shorter intervals. Baseball made a unique move this offseason that I don't think many of us saw coming, right? This thing, there was a 20-second gap between pitches. They dropped that down to 18. And I'm not sure this had to happen, right? This is with runners on base. We know that there's limits to how many times you can throw over. I was pretty pleased with the immediate turnaround in terms of pace of play and overall game time last year. And I feel like so was the rest of the world. Why did this specifically have to happen? And and just take it out. Should they roll this back immediately in conjunction with this conversation and how closely attached this pitch clock appears to be to the narrative of these pitcher injuries?
I don't know. Obviously we don't know causation, but I don't really understand why they did this. Like the hard, you know, to root cause the pitch clock, it was to sort of keep in line some of these pitchers. I mean, it was to just flat out speed up pace of play, but there are certain frequent offenders, right? So those specific players that drag things out, starts were 4-5+ hours, right? So we wanted to provide a little bit of structure to the game for those kind of, you know, eliminate those types of situations. Now, it like you said, it worked perfectly last year to the point where I don't really know why we needed to to take it a step further. So short answer is I have no idea why they did that. And I think that they should at least look at steps to kind of reverse it a little bit. Like I do overall like the pitch clock in terms of pace of play. But I don't think we need to be like shortening it and tightening it up as we go. Right. And that is like the lowest hanging fruit. I think that's where this MLPA stuff came out, where like it was probably a major point of negotiation in the CBA to begin with, that players didn't want that this to be, you know, in terms of like health and safety standards, but for them to then, encroach on it even more, I think is where they probably felt, they were taken advantage of further. So
yeah, it just seems a little greedy. I mean, they guinea pig this stuff in AAA, and, you know, they dropped it down to 17 seconds in AAA for, I think, the final month and a half or so. And there were basically no increases in violations, according to the data that I'm reading here right now. That's not the point, right? The fact that pitchers were able to pitch the ball within the time limit isn't the point. All right. It's completely reckless to do these studies without extrapolating out a couple of years and seeing what kind of damage this might be doing. You know, I'm all for pitchers pitching. I'm not against this. And I wish we could go back 15 years and we could have, you know, more complete games and all that. I'm not saying that this should be where we head with the game. It just seems like this one was greedy. Like, oh, look what it did to our overall game clocks. Can we get it under 230 this year? Can we actually make it something that's even better than what we saw last year? It's greedy. It's just greedy to me. I think I'm with the PA on this one specifically. And there were other ways to do this. Put a limit on how many times the catchers can throw down, right? There's other ways to do this that everybody sees in the game right now. So I'm not going to say this is a huge factor because I don't have the data. Nobody has the data to know that the pitch clock has actually made pitcher injuries more prevalent. My initial thinking with bringing you on was we really do talk about this every single season. Anybody who plays fantasy baseball knows one of your pitchers is going down for the year. 60-man IL, it's going to happen. It's just the nature of the sport. It's the nature of where things are. I know you've listened to a bunch of pods. You've heard some of these active and former players talk on this. Is this fixable? I mean, we've talked so much about velocity and spin rate and all these companies like Driveline that are pushing this gamut, right? They are taking this position to the absolute max level. Everything about this is give me 75 pitches with maximum spin rate or maximum velocity. And I don't know if pitchers can change that philosophy because the ones who are doing that the best are the ones securing $200 million. The problem is this, and I want to focus on this with you, Dan. What happens when owners start to running back this process? What happens when instead of service time manipulation with these players, they bring them up at 19 years old? Right out of college, right? Paul Skeens brought up immediately, number one pick. We never saw that before. Never. Those players always had 2-3 years of ramping up in the minor leagues, right? Now they're here. Isn't the point that they're going to run out their 6-year clock and then maybe never pay them? And isn't this going to become the way of the world? Aren't we a half a decade away from talking about how starting pitchers may never get paid ever again?
I'm of that mindset. Yeah. I mean, I, after our kind of conversation this morning, I took a look back at like historical $100 million contracts in free agency for pitchers. And it's been pretty flat where we've had three pitchers get $100 million in free agency over the last, I think it was 5 years. But I have a feeling that that is going to start to trend a little bit lower here in terms of players getting locked up with, you know, pre-arb or arbitration extensions, and or just guys not really making it 6 years, you know, 6 healthy years throughout, you know, their pre-arb arbitration timeline. So, yeah, like we, to your earlier point, we are going to start talking about this every year to some degree. Like, let me back up a half step. I saw a tweet alluding at, if the current pace holds, that we'll see double the Tommy John surgeries that we did last year. Now
we're 10 days into the year. So doing that division is insane.
So we're chopping up an already small sample size of a season and 2 weeks into now an even smaller sample size. I think we're getting, it's getting really dicey. And there is, if anything, there's some data that alludes to pitching injuries occurring earlier in the season. Now, whether that's being ready, ramping up, cold weather, maybe a combination of all those factors, who really knows? But like, we had the same conversation last year after Tyler Glasnow went down early, and he specifically pointed at the pitch clock, and we all threw our arms up and said, this pitch clock is going to cause every, I think I even was like, if he's saying it, I think we're going to start to see a lot of signal in the future with, you know, or that this is signal, and we'll start to see pitchers getting injured down, you know, further into the season. It really didn't happen. I mean, there were more injuries last year, but the pace through the first month of the season did not hold, is my point here. So again, it's early in the season. We've seen a couple big names go down. We're all very emotional about that, you know, as fans and observers of the sport. So, you know, again, pitcher health is important. This may very well be signal that in 5 years from now, we're looking back and say, yeah, that was a major change that affected pitcher health, and that we should have, you know, taken action a little sooner. But it's very possible that this is just more of the same, right? And you know, in future years, we're just, it's going to be inevitable. Like the pitch clock, putting guys into a, you know, making them pitch max, or having guys who are pitching max effort, max spin within a certain,
rewarding those players. Right.
Right. But, and adding in the 30 seconds in between pitches or whatever you want to call it, like it's going to break. Like you need rest and recovery between pitches, or they're going to need to decrease their velocity / spin. So like, something has to break. We're seeing it break a little bit here. How we move forward, I have no clue. But to your original question, I have trouble believing this gets fixed. And I think this is just going to be quote unquote fixed, right? I mean, like, what does this being fixed look like? Who knows? But I mean, this would take massive change at multiple levels, including little league, high school, college, through the minors, you know, team philosophies at the major league level, right? I mean, like, velocity, spin rate is not only sexy, but it is, there's data that shows that it has a massive impact on performance, right? So if that's going to get you noticed, if that's what's going to get you to be a major league pitcher, I think, you know, young players think it's worth the risk of having Tommy John surgery in order to try and be a major league pitcher without really taking into consideration trying to get, you know, 6+ years of service time to hit free agency, right? How rare is that? Like, how many millions of kids play baseball, and how few of them are actually like, have the mindset of like, I'm going to make it to the majors and I need to be worrying about my arm health for the next, you know, into my mid-20s and 30s, right? Yeah. Like, that, it's just not a thing. If 17-year-old me had the chance, if you told me you could have the chance, you have the talent and could have the chance to be a major leaguer, but you have an 80% chance, 90% chance of having Tommy John surgery at some point in your career, I would probably take that risk any day of the week, right? So it's a mentality shift at multiple levels to the point where I don't really know if it, you know, this is not death also, right? It's Tommy John surgery. I don't want to like discredit that, but like, for instance, Spencer Strider already had Tommy John surgery, which is why the internal brace surgery is being discussed now, that he might not need full blown Tommy John again. And his window, you know, to being back on the mound might be way sooner than, you know, somebody like Shane Bieber, who is probably going to need full Tommy John and, you know, a full recovery period. So I know that was like a long winded.
No, it's good. It's good. I got two more things to say. This is probably the most woke segment we're going to have, and I apologize for that. Isn't it extremely plausible that climate change has something to do with this, Dan? I just quickly looked at the Guardians and the Braves schedules for the first 10 days of the season. Okay. The Braves were at Philly and at Chicago. And I watched the Chicago series, and it looked like the coming of hell. All right. Snowing, raining, miserable wind in Chicago. It's just not what it was 15 years ago in April. And by the way, this season started March 28th, which is the conversation I'm trying to have here. This can't be good for players, right? I've already put two dozen players on the IL with hamstring injuries. That's the position player part of this. But you can't tell me that keeping arms warm in 45 degree weather, right? Cleveland went to Seattle and Minnesota. It's 45 in Seattle. It's 40 something in Minnesota. I realize there's coverage to those stadiums. It doesn't matter. The climate that they're operating in is still 40 degrees and less. We're not seeing West Coast players hit the shelf right now, are we? We're just not. I bet you if I ran the data, and I'll do it as a Twitter homework assignment here. I bet you if I ran the data on ILs in the first 10 days of the season, it is heavily skewed to the East Coast. It is heavily skewed to the North, where the temperatures are in the 30s and the 40s. And that's part of this. So yes, the pitch clock is new. So is this drastic weather pattern that's changed, right? We're skiing in April instead of in December in the Northeast, because that's just how things have worked out now. Things have shifted maybe a full month forward with how the cold weather exists in the Northeast, and certainly getting down into the Virginias and the Carolinas, right? It's got to be a factor here. And you can say they got to do a better job warming up. That's fine. These guys go sit on the bench for 25 minutes while their team hits. It's really hard. That's really hard. It's an unbelievably difficult sport in a lot of reasons, and this is one of them. I just want that to be part of this conversation, that the league scheduling March games in the Northeast and in the East at all has to be a factor with what the weather is doing to some of these muscles, whether it's an arm muscle, whether it's a hamstring muscle, et cetera, et cetera. And the other thing is this. One of the reasons that Shane Bieber is a big focal point here for us is A, that's your guy on your team, and B, he's 3 months from free agency. He's done everything else correctly, right? He's been a good soldier. He's run through his service time. Maybe he turned down an offer or two from Cleveland. You know, it was low because it's Cleveland. And he was just about to get to the finish line. And now he's going to have to go through a full year of recovery with free agency, probably take some sort of bridge contract like Tyler Glasnow did, and hope that it works out like Glasnow got, right? $136 million with the best team in baseball. So it's a really tough situation to see a guy go through all the 6 years of service, then have this happen. And now who knows financially? It's just a complete who knows. That's going to be part of this, right? Because that's just another operation that teams can look at to say, well, you never know when it's going to happen. And you're right, Dan. You said this out loud, and I know you've heard this quite a bit. Players almost want to get the surgery during their pre-ARB years. They want to get the first one done, like Spencer Strider did, so that the next iteration is sort of a half surgery, a half recovery, which we've seen now multiple times. We've got guys out there throwing seven innings out with three Tommy Johns. Okay, the technology's been unbelievable with where it's gone. I'm not saying I'm for it. It's crazy that this is part of the game, but it's part of the game. But when it lines up with free agency like it did here for Glasnow and for Bieber, it stinks on the highest level. And I'm not saying we can change that, but man, it's brutal to see the top players in the game have to go through this. And it's a factor of what? Weather, rules, and just the way that we are rewarding pitching. Rewarding pitching starting at age 12, like you mentioned. This is happening at age 12. There's kids hooked up to freaking AI technology right now working on a slurve at age 13, Dan, right? With an iPad in front of them, understanding their spin rate. It's happening. It's happening in all the major baseball pockets of the world. So you're telling me that's not going to have an immediate impact when that kid turns 22? It's gonna. We know it's gonna. We're not stupid, right? This is going to be a thing that just continues to happen. And it's not because of the pitch clock. It's because of how early this is starting and when we get to the point of when it actually has to matter, right? When these kids, when 1% of these kids actually get to the major leagues. But I'm looking at year one through year six, right? And Bieber's now year six. Something has to give, right? We have to get to a point where we're doing this at 13 and expect them to be 28 and 29 and then get a $200 million contract. There's no way that's going to happen, right? So you can tell me that pitching has to change. It has to change at age 12. It has to change from the dad coaching, throwing a kid out there for the max amount of pitching that their league allows or their travel system allows, and expecting that kid to just be great into his 30s. It's never going to happen. That's way too long of a timeline, right? So it's a bigger problem than the pitch clock, a much bigger problem than some of the media members are making it out to be. And I just hope that becomes the overarching story, which is if you, it's not even about getting to Major League Baseball, right? You want to go have a cup of coffee in Major League Baseball, change nothing, because that's what you're going to get. If you want to become a Major League Baseball pitcher who gets paid like a Major League Baseball pitcher, things better change on the ground floor, because it's never going to happen. I mean, literally, you are devaluing the process. And here's what's going to happen. It's going to become the running back position because they're just going to have 18 of you. They're just going to roll out an 8-man rotation, right? And they're going to pay you $2 million each. And they're going to expect you to give 6 innings once a week forever. And you're going to devalue yourself in that regard. And that sucks. Because nobody's going to know who you are if you're pitching once a week, maybe once every 10 days. You're going to become a nobody. You're just going to become a flash in the pan on a 28-man roster, because that's what they'll do, right? They'll increase the roster size, right? Which lowers everybody's pay. And they'll increase the starting rotation to 6 to 8 players, which, again, lowers every starting pitcher's pay. So that's where we're headed. We're headed into a pitching by committee, which is going to drop salaries, and it's going to heavily lower everybody's ability to cash in on a big level. So I'm looking at this from a money mindset, because it's the finish line. Shane Bieber was at the finish line and now he can't get there. He might never get there, right? And that sucks. So 12-year-olds and 13-year-olds have to figure this stuff out before 29-year-olds get paid. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put this, right? We're not two guys here just giving hot takes on elbow injuries. Nope. Financial website, we're trying to link this back. And this is going to have major, major financial ramifications in the years to come. Now, exactly where that goes, how this plays out, is going to be hard to forecast, right? Because it's like, if we just kind of project this out, like my guess of where this goes in 10 years is teams have a roster of 12 guys who can give you 3 innings, right? There's no more guys in 10, you know, you're trying to get 6 innings out of. There's no more guys who are only stretched out to give you one inning or fit, you know, 20, 25 pitches. It's just going to be, you know, there's tons of data backing up times through the order. You know, pitchers are less effective the more times you go through the batting order. I think it's just going to be like guys who pitch once every 3 days, 3 innings once through the order, something like that. But now where does that go? That's going to have all sorts of financial implications if it were to go that route. Let's just say pitchers, I don't think this would happen, but let's just say pitchers start saying, I'm going to throw 90% instead of 100%, and I'm going to spin it 80% instead of 100%, whatever. Like in theory, you would think that pitching performance would decrease, offense would increase, does that then lead the baseball to have to correct, you know, course correct and create rules, whether that's pitching mound rules or, you know, other, you know, base, you know, length of between bases, you know, different rule changes may very well come of that, right?
Can so they raise the mound again, Dan?
Well, that's probably going to be their next thing, is they're going to have the mound be closer again or change the angle of it. That's going to be, they're going to start messing with stuff like that. But that's where it's like, if you keep.
But that is something that the league can do as a way to say, guys, dial it back a little bit. Like, we're going to take care of you with the ball. We're going to take care of you with, you know, bring back the ball that didn't fly out of the park so much.
Right.
So, there's ways to do this, scientifically speaking, that doesn't impact the elbow, right? You know what I mean? Like, like, hey, you guys take care of yourselves so that we can all prosper together. We're going to raise the mound. We're going to shorten the distance. We're going to do whatever we have to do with the ball to make hitting a little bit harder, which is insane because it's probably the single hardest thing to do in all of sports is hit a freaking baseball. But I get it. There's ways to keep the pitch clock. There's ways to keep the slurve. There's ways to keep all these things that have been good for the game that the league can change, right? And I think that's a good way to leave this, is baseball should do something, right? And then pitchers can react to it with how they come down to 90% like you're talking about, because they're not going to right now. Because Jordan Alvarez is hitting everything out of the goddamn ballpark right now, right? And there's 12 versions of him. So they're just not going to. You said it great to me this morning. If the car can go 140, every pitcher is going to try to go 140, right? If that's what somebody told them once, if they were in one batting cage and threw the ball 140 on the radar, they're going to try to do that every freaking time, because that's going to, you know, decrease the home run rate and the walk, everything that they need to try to get paid in this league, even though counteractively it's a catch 22. I'd love for the league to do something immediately. And this is one of the rare sports that can change the rules right now. They don't have to wait for a CBA. They don't have to wait for an offseason. They can do it right now. They can roll back that 18 seconds to 20 seconds tomorrow if they want to. They just need a board vote. So I'd love to see it happening. And if you've got more ideas of what they can do, for sure, bring it to us.
I mean, I don't actually know if that plays out. I'm just trying to like forecast how multiple parties are appeased in this. And oh, by the way, the owners are going to love that scenario where pitchers never accumulate the stats, or, you know, they never put the profile together to earn $100 million contract. Right. So like that, my guess is 10 years from now, that's where the league heads in a, you know, there may always be outlier elite pitchers who you're able to rely on for, you know, six innings or whatever. But I think as a whole, pitching stats will go in that direction for a multitude of reasons, because primarily in one of those reasons is financial, but the owners will be able to launder that financial reason as a health and safety reason, you know, if you catch my drift. I don't know where it goes from here.
Is the Blake Snell contract just going to become the new thing, right? I mean, is that kind of where we're headed? Probably.
Well, that's part of it too. I mean, you and I've been, you know, hinting at this for years, that as these high-end pitching contracts get to the financial thresholds that they are, it becomes even more risky with a high, you know, a high injury, high risk player like a pitcher, that the trajectory should go more towards high AAV, shorter term pitching deals, in my opinion. And instead of these like 10, 12 year contracts, I understand that's luxury tax. That has luxury tax implications, but
come on,
in general. Yeah, right.
That's peanut. That's literally couch change at the end of the year. If you're not the New York Mets, right? I mean, the Mets know that they've effed up last year and they've already dialed everything back. So it's never going to get to that point again.
And aren't deferrals just, circumventing the whole adding term to circumvent the luxury tax thing?
Like, certainly a great year to talk about that. Yes, of course.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's going to be the new,
Can I finish on one thing here, Dan? The way that I hate to bring football into everything, but we have to, right? Got to pay the bills. The way that the running backs are trying to fix this is by adding versatility to their game, is by becoming more than one position. right? And it's working to some degree. We're seeing unbelievable talent come out of college football and translate into the NFL. And I do think there'll be a nice wave of gadget prospects that come into the league and force teams to at least guarantee 2 to 3 years, right? Barkley got a 2.5 year guarantee here. Will there be a dozen more of him coming out of the league soon? Maybe. There's no world where starting pitchers can do this, Dan. They don't hit anymore, right? And you can't ask them to be starting pitchers for 6 months and then closers for three, I don't think, right? Maybe you can ask them to be starting pitchers for 4 years and then closers for 4 years, and then they get somewhat a semblance of a career out of it. Is it possible for them to change course outside of dialing back the spin and dialing back the velocity, right? Is there a world where this position can become more versatile and you have players that start some games and maybe come in for an inning here or two? Or is that just going to damage the arm even more, in your opinion?
Yeah, I don't really know if that is a direction it'll go. I mean, maybe, I think there's going to be a lot of searching here, right? And mm-hmm. and some teams may try some unique things, get creative, but perhaps, but I don't know if it'll go that route.
Final question. You got a son who's 18 years away from being scouted. You find out he can throw, right? He's got two pitches coming in the ninth grade, at least, right? And he's working on his third. Do you want him to be a starter or a closer?
Good question. Yeah, I mean, health-wise, I think if this is like a health, question. Yeah,
the whole gamut, the whole career, right?
I think relieving is a safe way to develop, if you will. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think, but there's plenty of holes in that, right? Spencer Strider was developed as a reliever, or Tommy John surgery, so it can happen either way. I think flat out pitching is just, if you're trying to make it as a pitcher at this point, unless things change over the next decade, right? I think you should just expect that arm injuries are probably in your future, right?
Yeah, so you're just dead either way, kind of.
But from like a financial value, I think you're also hinting at like from a financial value perspective. I guess I obviously starters for the past 20
not
years.
Not really, Dan.
Well, no, for the past 20 years, starting has been an extreme, I don't want to compare them to punters, but it's been a very advantageous position to be in financially, right? You pitch once every 5 days and yeah. You can make a huge, we're seeing guys paid $30 million a year. So, but going forward, if that is cut in half and those salaries are not really on the table, I really do wonder the direction. I don't know where this will go.
Let me put it this way. In the last couple of off seasons, you did that work on free agency, right? And we saw Snell and we saw Montgomery and we saw a bunch of these players over the past 3-4 off seasons get tempered free agent contracts, right? Not since really Cole have we seen a slam dunk free agent pitcher contract. And by the way, Cole's has worked out pretty damn well up to this point. I mean, he's been an absolute workhorse. Every single time a top reliever hits the market, they reset the market. Every single time. And that includes Liam Hendricks and Kenley Jansen and Josh Hader and Edwin Diaz. Every single time those guys get to the finish line, they get paid. That's not happening with starting pitching right now. So something is changing in that regard. And whether it's a current phase or whether it's a trend is something we have to watch. But I think you and I both think that this starting pitcher devaluation is coming from quickly, really quickly. And at the same time, this current injury stuff is overblown because these guys are recovering from these surgeries in a matter of no time. And they do have a chance to get back to it. And if it's not timed terribly like Bieber, there's still time to get a contract, but it's going to be part of the game. It's going to be part of high school baseball, college baseball, academy baseball, and major league baseball. And until people realize that these pitchers aren't getting to their seventh year to be able to cash in, or they or they've haven't accepted their pre-arb extension like Spencer Strider did. It's just not going to be there for them anymore, and that's going to be a wake-up call, right? So we'll see where we get to.
Yeah, my two things I'll leave you with. Former MLBer Trevor May was I heard him on a podcast recently with a quote that hit me a little bit, something along the lines of, most young players would rather be a major leaguer who had Tommy John than a nobody who never had surgery, right? Which sort of stuck with me, right? Like if you put yourself as a young person who is shooting to be a MLB player, but really doesn't know, I mean, you're going to just try, you're going to do whatever you can to get there. And if that's throwing 100 when your frame says you should only be maxing out at mid 90s, then I mean, that's probably what you're going to do. Right. So, but if anyone is looking for, you know, a more articulate version of what I said or what I was trying to say, I think the best soundbite I've heard on it is Justin Verlander. There's like a 5-minute soundbite floating around Twitter that really articulates the nuance of the problem that we're kind of dealing with at, you know, from multiple levels and how we sort of correct it. So I'd encourage anyone looking for a more articulate version of what I was trying to say to find that. So
yeah, other than that, what does he really know though?
Yeah, he doesn't know anything.
By the way, awful timing for that Steven Strasburg retirement notice. I mean, talk about putting everything into perspective. Holy cats. I feel like the Nationals were just trolling us all with that. All right. We'll obviously be monitoring this and it's something I didn't want to, I wanted this to be a twofold conversation. I wanted this to be, let's just calm down. Big guys going down stinks. It's terrible for the start of the season. It's part of the game. I also really want to continually talk about how this is not going to slow down. It's just not. And it's nothing to do with the pitch. Sorry. It's minimally the pitch clock, and certainly baseball can make some changes, but this is literally baseball. And it's what you're saying. It is owners directing scouts to go find 102 miles an hour because those pitchers can help them win tomorrow and won't be around in 7 years for the $100 million.
Yeah.
And that is the dirty little secret. They can win us games today, and they won't be healthy enough to earn that Gerrit Cole contract in 7 years. And they love that stuff because they're owners. So that's the secret that nobody really wants to say out loud, but because we do what we do, we have to say it out loud because the money devaluation is freaking coming, man. It's coming. All right. Appreciate your work as always, Dan. Thanks,
Mike.